Short disclaimer. This podcast is in no way affiliated with the Stars production or Diana Gabaldon. All views expressed are solely our own. Welcome to the Outlander podcast,
where the men are kilted, the women are winsome,
and the whiskey is neat. Welcome to episode 121 of the Outlander podcast. I'm Ginger.
And I'm Summer, and we are in love with all things Outlander. So, announcements this week. We didn't have an episode last week when this thing hit. The thing that kind of broke Twitter for me, because, like, literally once it happened, it was like, that's all I saw on my Twitter feed all day long.
You can't get any work done. I freaked the freak out. My friends were, and my, yeah, Summer was.
So, I'm your friend, I'm it?
And Summer was.
Oh, okay.
I never said you were my friend.
No, I would never, ever, ever say that. The thing that happened 2 weeks ago, or a week and a half ago, week and a half. I think it was like a week and a half. Okay. Anyway, it doesn't matter. It was not this week. It was last week. And that would be the season 2 teaser trailer.
That trailer. Now, before we say anything, and we've already discussed the trailer. We had that little live Google Hangout. So we're not going to really discuss it here. But before we get to the next announcement, I guess, that we have this week or this episode, we cannot forget to introduce a friend who's joining us again this evening.
I mean, we can. You do it quite often.
Our friend Mandy from many of our escapades is joining us tonight.
Good evening.
Good. You're disappointing us.
No, I was going to say, apparently you really wanted me once you found out on Twitter that I'd been sampling whiskey tonight. So.
No, that's, oh yeah, you're right, straight up. But you're disappointing us because you didn't give us your hello.
Hello.
There it is. Ding. Okay, the trailer was last week. Mandy, what was the other thing that happened this week?
You know, there was some kind of little awards thing that kept filling up my Twitter feed yesterday.
Oh my
Maybe
God.
The Golden Globes? Is All that day. What it was?
That would be the Golden Globes. And Outlander was nominated in 3 categories. I was a little confused with the way that they were nominated because the show itself was nominated for Best Drama. Katrina was nominated for Best Actress Drama. And Tobias, our own Black Jack Randall, was nominated for Best Supporting Actor in a Limited Series or Miniseries.
I took it verbatim from the Golden Globe site. So you're absolutely right. The Best Television Series Drama was the category Outlander was nominated in. The category that Katrina was nominated in was Best Performance by an Actress in a Television Series Drama. And then Tobias's is like a year long.
That's because they don't break down the supporting roles into drama and comedy.
Yeah, exactly. So it's Best Performance by an Actor in a Supporting Role. Okay, that gives you how big it is. In a series, miniseries, or motion picture made for television. So basically, the best supporting actor on TV overall.
Correct.
Okay, now we're clear that that's as long as could be. So, we're thrilled. I don't think anyone is surprised that Tobias made it or that Katrina made it. And, of course, the show, which is thrilling. There's a lot of opinion about Sam not being included among the nominees.
Well, I mean, clearly we're all disappointed he wasn't nominated. But, you know, it's in the scheme of things.
Yeah.
The way that I feel about awards is that awards, while they're fun and great, and it's nice to be recognized for what you're doing by your peers, if you consider them your peers, in the end of the day, it's not about the awards, it's about the work. And as long as they keep producing amazing shows, I don't really care if they ever win an award. Some of the best shows that I've ever enjoyed and loved never won anything.
Did Hannibal ever win anything?
No.
It was like this little show that just went.
To me, the work that Sam did contributed to the nomination of Outlander overall.
Absolutely.
And I get a little irritated and annoyed when I see all the headlines and complaints about that Sam was quote-unquote snubbed. I don't think it's that at all. They're not saying purposefully that Sam didn't deserve something. All they're saying is that of all the great performances out there, his wasn't necessarily in the top 5.
Right.
Or however many.
And think about how many shows there are.
Exactly.
And for them to narrow that down to five.
Yeah.
So
one of the things I've said online is basically I'm not hurt over it. I'm not, I guess you could say I'm a little bit disappointed, only in that it's like everybody but Sam was given a nod. I get it. I'm not in disagreement that it would have been nice and awesome to have him there. However, I'm trying to look at it objectively. If you look at the body of work, not the quality, the body of work that Katrina had assigned to her as her role of Claire, that Tobias had assigned to him in his two roles of Frank and Blackjack Randall, and then Sam, right, who had all of Jamie Fraser. Yes, we love Jamie, and yes, of course, he's good looking, he's a great actor, all the stuff that everyone says, which I don't disagree with. If you look at everything, number one, Katrina deserved it probably more than anyone. She is the first season, she carries that show. Without Claire falling through the stones, there is no Jamie. So Katrina, again, I don't think anyone's trying to take anything away from her. So she, to me, is maybe not a shoo-in, but she's someone, I think, who should be recognized. So that makes sense. Tobias. I loved his Frank. His BJR was stellar. And the amount, the range that Katrina had to show was ridiculous, right? And the range and the differences that Tobias, the actor, had to show in his two roles, you know, night and day, the range was spectacular. It's not that Sam didn't do a good job with what he was given.
Sam's role built over the course of the entire season.
Exactly. And Sam's major meat, the role that, the meat that he
Can
was.
Can we not talk about his meat?
I have to.
Exactly.
The
Please
meat,
don't.
The meat of his role, acting chops wise, they were able to be shown in the last two episodes. Doesn't mean he didn't shine everywhere else, but Katrina was given meat Katrina was given meat early on. Tobias owned episode 6. Tobias shone in Lallybroch. Tobias shone in 115 and 116. So there's no one is saying that they don't agree with that, right? No one is saying that that they all didn't shine. But if you look at the amount and range, they all have wonderful acting chops. But if you look at the amount and range of what they were given, it's almost incomparable. You can't, it's not almost not a fair comparison. Again, we're not talking talent. We're talking what were they given to work with.
Well, let's not even talk about that. I was reading an article today that Ron Moore, it was an interview that Ron Moore gave right after the Globes were announced. And he was stating about Katrina is that she was literally in every scene. In every scene. Katrina being able to, like,
hold it.
Be it. Period. It would not have worked. You know what I mean? So that if Outlander had been nominated and she had not, it would have made
almost no sense. I agree.
But that would have stated unequivocally that they were nominated because it was a fantastic ensemble and that no one person, you know, shone.
I agree. Now, to take it a tiny bit further before we go on to our read-along. So this was part of my discussion about Sam not being nominated. Okay, if you look at, they all have stellar acting chops. The meat they were given was...
Stop.
I'm sorry,
no more
Summer.
Meat.
The stuff they were given, I mean, the writing was all wonderful, but the stuff they were given was just different. And it's almost not fair to compare. They've all shown, but it was just different. And to me, I would have loved to have seen Sam given a nomination. Absolutely. But if you're going to have to leave one out, Tobias and Kate, I would say I agree with the nominations. That's all I'm saying. So that's the first part. The second part is, speaking of Sam and Jamie and all of that, this is totally speculation. We have no news. We have no knowledge. We're hoping, just like every listener out there is at this time in late 2015, depending on, dear listener, when you're listening to this. At this point, we do not have any announcement of any... We don't even have a premiere date for season 2, let alone a promise of a season 3, correct? However, if we just say for funsies, or for shiggles, that we had a season 3, which is the book about... would hopefully be about the book Voyager. Whether they split it into two seasons, or just have one, whatever. Whatever equals the first half of that book. Yes, stuff happens. I don't want to get ahead of ourselves because we're still doing the read-along of book 2. But Jamie, or so Sam, Jamie owns the first half of that book. Yes, Claire's awesome. Yes, other people are awesome. Jamie owns the first half of that book dramatically. So what I'm trying to get at is, we're talking about season one nominations, right? Season two, and I know I skipped to three, if we get it. But season two, I can see that all three would have the opportunity, knowing what's in book two, I would see them all being able to shine.
Yeah, I'm sure they'll be able to shine. The way the Foreign Press Association works, they very rarely do a lot of repeat nominations and repeat
categories.
Yeah, of people in the same category. I mean, we'll see. I'm firmly convinced there will be a season three, and from what I'm seeing, I don't think they're going to split it, but we'll see.
You're breaking my heart.
That's on what I found more interesting in the press that Ron did yesterday after the announcements is, aside from the fact that he's promising to have Bree and Claire announcements Bree and Roger announcements very, very soon. He talked about the challenge that it was to adapt season two and that there were more changes from the source material than in series one. And that is going to be very interesting to see.
Well, we saw we talked about it in the Google Hangout, which was, we gave spoiler warnings up the jing-jang that, look, we're going to talk about book two.
Mm-hmm.
We're past that in our read-along, so hopefully someone who's listening to this episode for chapter 33, we're past that part. Do you think it's fair to talk about something from the trailer?
Sure.
Okay, so just as an example of what you were saying, right, to illustrate that, it's not a change in the storyline per se as far as big events that happen, but the fact that the two of them, if it's what we think it is, right, the fact that the two of them were visiting Faith's grave, or a grave, if that's that.
I quite frankly will be shocked if that actually turns out to be what we think it is. Because think of what happened with the teaser trailers for series one.
You're right.
You know, the things like, you know, I'm from the future. None of it ever ended up being what we thought it was going to be.
Nobody's going to have a dream about going to a grave site in a book where there's clearly a death that we all know about.
Well, I mean, I find it very hard to believe they would have given away something that big in a teaser. And it's big for people who haven't read the book.
You're 100% right. We know this from experience. We were all kind of pulled in and couldn't believe it. We were pretty sure they weren't going to make that kind of twist. But, you know, it looked like it. And thankfully, it was not a dream. It was kind of a vision, right? Yeah, who knows? This, to someone who doesn't know, it could very well be like a distractor, right? Trying to make you think something. And I agree. If they totally uber obvious what was going on, I could see that being a humongous spoiler. But I would guess that someone who knows nothing about book two and has only ever seen series one watching that trailer, I wouldn't guess that because they're bending over a grave. And first of all, I missed the ding dong spoon. I think most people did. If you watched it 20 times and listened to anyone break anything down, I think you probably saw it or heard about it. But I wouldn't know what the spoon was. I wouldn't think that just because Jamie and Claire are at a grave,
that it was necessarily
that they lost
that.
A baby.
Well, it's true, but let's also, for the people who haven't read the books, they should know.
They should not be listening.
They won't be listening. I'm just saying, they wouldn't know that. They wouldn't know that Diana Gabaldon is famous for killing children and animals. So...
And can we say one final thing before we move past the teaser?
Yeah, sure.
I've heard from a person in a position to know that so far they've really only shown us the ordinary stuff for France. That there's spectacular stuff that has not been shown at all.
Nice.
So we may not survive. But
oh, good Lord. Yeah.
I mean, if I've survived Droughtlander, I'm pretty sure I can survive.
The thing about Droughtlander...
Young things.
The thing about Droughtlander is it's all... I mean, don't get me wrong. You still want stuff, but it's all about anticipation, right? And now that we've actually started this stuff, mm-hmm. that they're bringing stuff out, it's becoming more exciting. It's not just like, oh my gosh, come out already, although it still is. It's actually something to sink your teeth into a little bit now.
But that being said, because we are in the holiday season, let's all just remember that Starz doesn't have to give us anything. And let's just be grateful anytime they do give us anything.
Absolutely.
Yes. And with that...
With that, I want announcement of Roger and Bree soon.
Oh my gosh.
So, Amanda, you and I have chatted a little bit about this offline. And while we both really want Roger and Bree announcement, we also want the premiere date.
Well, yeah, you know, I don't care so much about the date. We know pretty, I mean, we can narrow it down pretty definitively as to when it's going to be. Outlander is going to air after Black Sails finishes, 99.9% sure. And we know that Black Sails is starting January 23rd. We know about how many episodes Black Sails runs. So we know, you know, give or take a week or so, what time in April the Outlander is going to start. I still think probably the last thing of Outlander offering will probably be the air date. Have no reason to know that. That's just, you know, my gut feeling. I think that probably announcement of Roger and Bree will be one of the Outlander offerings, mainly because they've got to start filming those scenes soon. And Ron has said that there will definitely be Roger and Bree in this season. And I can't imagine any way they film those two characters without the
without
scene.
Without it getting out.
Right. Well, without the scene in the graveyard where they find Jamie's grave, that has to be done outside.
Yeah.
And they can't keep a secret once they start filming something outside.
And those darn bakers will find it.
Exactly. They will.
Our friends, our lovely, amazing friends.
Absolutely.
Ridiculously, food coma inducing friends.
Yes.
I mean, find it.
I've personally thought of a few ways they could get around doing it, but that would include sound stages.
I don't know that you could do a graveyard very effectively on a soundstage. Not and have it compare favorably to the way they've shot other graveyards in the series.
And I don't disagree with that statement. However, I would also like to point out that it is currently winter in Scotland.
Very true.
And I don't recall. It was rainy season in the book when they were visiting Scotland, and it was rainy.
Brianna was out of school, so it must have been... Oh, no, you're right, but there was tons of rain.
They talked about wellies. Yeah,
but it always rained.
And
exactly.
You're right. Macintoshes. Yeah. And so it was definitely rainy, but I don't think that it was particularly wintry.
It wasn't snowy, no.
Well, right, yeah, and it would be a lot harder to find a gravestone that said Jamie Fraser on it if it was snowing, because it wouldn't be something you happened upon.
Even right now, it's not snowing that much at the lower elevations. Yes, they're having snow in Scotland, but it's mostly up north. So the areas that they've used so far for those graveyard type scenes have all been around Glasgow, and it's not going to be quite as high a chance of having snow in that area as it would be if you're further up in the Highlands.
Fine.
So that part doesn't worry me so much. But anyway, that's my logical rationale in my mind as to why they have to announce it sooner rather than later.
Okay, so are we betting? Oh, we're not putting money out there, but just for fun, are we betting that Roger and Bree will come before the date? You think the date will be last?
I think so. I think as great as Roger and Bree are, I think the announcement of a premiere date, air date, is more important in the grand scheme of things.
Yeah, I think I agree. And the reason I was saying I want the date is not just because obviously it would be nice to have confirmation. While our gut may say, yeah, it's going to follow Black Sails and we think it's going to be blah, blah, blah. I mean, I don't want to put...
It has to follow Black Sails because they don't have time to wait for a whole nother series to air like Power or whatever.
Oh, I know, but I'm saying I don't want to schedule my plane flight based on Black Sails. I'm saying that's why I would prefer the date first.
All right. That, my friends, was announcements, a very long announcement. So with that being said, let's move on to our read-along. This week, we are discussing Chapter 33, entitled Thy Brother's Keeper.
I want to point out, I finally got one without a sex scene in it.
But they discuss sex in it.
We were asking Mandy, you want to join us? Like, really late, really last notice, and she's like...
She's like, why is there sex in the chapter?
No. She said, really? I'm like, yeah. And then she said, is there sex in the chapter? And I'm like...
That just always seemed to be the way it works out.
So we're happy that Mandy is joining us. And the reason I was asking Summer, say that again? Is because the chapter, she had it right. The chapter is Thy Brother's Keeper. I wrote down on my notes, right, My Brother's Keeper, which is actually the opposite of Thy.
It's true.
Which is kind of funny. Okay. So... Connie and Lisity, the contributors this week, both mentioned the biblical source of the title. Connie writes, Brother's keeper is a phrase we hear early in the book of Genesis. Cain kills Abel out of jealousy. And then when the Lord asks Cain where Abel is, Cain replies, trying to change the subject, with, I know not,
Am I my brother's keeper? What responsibility do human beings have for the care of each other, including siblings? Lisa T. shares, the difference between the verse from Genesis and the title of this chapter is that the title is a statement and not a question. Throughout the chapter, we see variations on the theme of being thy brother's keeper. Two other themes that Connie points out are those of relationships and knowing. She writes, there are many layers of knowing someone. I hope I can convey what I mean here. When you really, truly have a deep understanding and knowledge of another person, of who that person is at his or her very core, the essence of their being, that's a profound kind of knowing. And in a spiritual sense, it's an experience in which one enters into the other, capital O. It's a kind of knowing that is in the bone and sinew of the two who are bound in a relationship, which could be marriage, the two shall become one flesh, blood of my blood, bone of my bone, or, as with Jamie and Ian, in a deep and enduring friendship, reinforced by their family ties and their history together. So the last chapter, 32, saw the Frasers and the Murrays and the estate of Lallybroch working to harvest their first potato crop. This chapter opens with information, a little bit of information, about Fergus. We see Fergus becoming part of Lallybroch. He becomes stable lad along with Rabbi McNab. Connie writes, Fergus's level of knowing here is very tentative. He's learning his way and finding where he fits in at Lallybroch. There's still a lot of testing and boundary challenging going on. Lisa T. writes, we see that the boys, unlike Cain and Abel, are united in their tribulation, not destroyed by it. Also, any time Rabbi McNab is mentioned, it harkens back to his father's betrayal of Jamie in Outlander. Jamie intervenes in one of the daily fights between the boys. We can presume that he beats them, or, you know, spanks them, whatever you want to call it, with his belt, since in this occurrence, when he's leaving the barn where he took them to do the deed, he was putting his belt back on. We learn more about young Jamie. He looks just like his father, Ian, but will likely be more the size of his uncle, Jamie. He also looks to be left-handed.
I would like to give kudos to Diana Gabaldone for coming up with so many different ways to say left-handed. Like in the last book, there was,
cat-handed,
and now this time it's...
Kari-fisted.
And yeah. Then also left-handed. She hasn't used southpaw in this book yet, but it could come. You've never heard southpaw?
Never.
Yeah.
Never?
What?
Oh, wow.
Well, hardly ever.
Okay.
Where have you been?
Look. That was tremendously off-key or out of tune, all of the above, but what is that from?
Mikado?
It's something Gilbert and Sullivan.
Or is it Pirates of Penzance?
I think it's Pirates of Penzance.
It might be the modern Major General.
I think so. Jamie had lots of trouble as a young boy with people trying to get him to use his right hand. Everyone but Ian's father, we learned. So this is new information. We didn't know this before. He'd said that it would be a sin to spurn the gift of strength in his left arm because this had been given by God, basically. And then Jamie's dad, Brian, had listened to Ian's father and he had learned to fight left-handed. Of course, we as readers, at least the first time you're reading this, the only thing we knew about Jamie fighting was that Dougal, his left-handed uncle, had taught him. But now we find out that it was actually Ian's father who taught him first.
This just makes me think of The Princess Bride when they're having that fight scene and him and it,
the dread. I know something you don't know.
Right. He's like, I am not left-handed. I am not left-handed. And then he's like, I am also not left-handed. Like it was...
John Murray, Ian's father, had also told Ian it was his job to stand at Jamie's right hand and guard his chief's weaker side. Ian took this, yes, an order, but also his charge. Yeah, his role. He took it very seriously, and they became together a very good fighting team. And to this day, or in the book, to that day.
Yeah.
Even though, you know, the next door neighbor's over there. To this day, in the story, at this point, even though he only has one leg, he still walks on Jamie's right side.
I can't read On Your Right Man without tearing up.
I know. Stop it. Oh, gosh. I know. So Lisa writes, to stand on someone's right is also a place of honor. and the significance of Ian guarding Jamie's right side is even more important now, since Jack Randall maimed Jamie's right hand. This is actually the next thing I'm about to say came to me after I put in all of our contributions. I was reminded of the phrase from the Nicene Creed, seated at the right hand of the Father. And that, thanks to Lisa, that she triggered that in my mind. Lisa also writes, Jenny then tells Claire, quote, I hope it's a boy. It's good for a man to have a brother to help him. At this point, Claire looks up at the portrait of Willie, Jamie's older deceased brother, resting his hand protectively on Jamie's shoulder. This is again a twist on Cain and Abel, as Cain did not protect his brother, but instead murdered him. In this case, Willie knew his responsibility was to protect his younger brother, but sadly was not able to protect Jamie because he died. Willie could not be his brother's keeper.
This is what I was thinking about when I looked up into the sky with a questioning look and you were confused. In the series, on the show, he maims his left hand.
Yeah.
Not his right hand.
I'm talking about the book.
I know you are, yes. But I'm just saying that that will not be something they can do in the series because they maimed his left hand.
I think people have given up on him being left-handed.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's why I was confused. I was like, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah, they just, I mean, it wasn't something that Sam could really carry out for an extended period of time.
So talk moves to Dougal and Colum. Jenny asks Claire about the latter. Jenny says she's always wondered about him, but her parents would never speak of him. And then she corrects herself and says, well, once her father did. Quote, God help Dougal Mackenzie when his brother Colum dies. Claire tries to describe the relationship between the brothers. She says it was symbiotic. And of Colum, quote, if the brothers, that famous line we know, if the brothers Mackenzie have but one cock and one brain between them, then I'm glad of my half of the bargain.
I like that passage because to me it further illustrates between Claire and Jenny their differences mm-hmm. in terms of how worldly Claire is because she's been all these many places and met all these different people. And Jenny's never really been further than what? 10 miles from home?
Yeah.
Brockmorta.
Yeah.
But for all that, she knows an awful lot about what's going on everywhere.
Oh, yeah, totally.
Because she listens. She says, I listen to what they say and I listen to what they don't say.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
So she's very smart and earthy, that Jenny.
Yeah.
Lisa T. writes, Jenny and Claire then discuss another set of brothers, Colum and Dougal, and their unique protective relationship as brothers. And Lisa T. also liked that same quote that we just liked. And she says, again, this is a variation on a theme of what it means to be thy brother's keeper.
Mm-hmm. And it's so interesting that Colum and Dougal, being actual blood brothers, actually have much more strife and things between them than Jamie and Ian, who aren't really blood brothers, actually have a much closer relationship.
Well, it's something that you see a lot more of now with chosen families, like mm-hmm. the families you make as opposed to the families you're born into. And I think that it's along those lines. But they did grow up together, so, I mean, they were as close as brothers, and because Jamie's brother didn't survive his childhood, mm-hmm. it was the closest thing he had.
Yeah. But apparently growing up together doesn't always bring closeness, because you can look at Dougal and Colum.
You could look at me and Ginger.
And I do.
Oh, my Lord.
You do.
Does that mean I'm Colum?
Yes.
So you have the cock.
So big.
There's no possible comment.
I'm sorry. What, Mandy?
I said so many possible comments.
Right?
Mandy asked that there was sex in this chapter, and apparently...
We can make it sexy. Let's do this.
Oh, no.
No?
Okay. That wasn't where I was going.
No. You've got the cock, so... Put it away. Jenny's made out, apparently quicker than Claire had, that Dougal is the biological father of young Hamish. And that's where... What you were saying, right? That she pays attention to what people say, but also to what they don't say.
Exactly. And now Claire was like, you know, you caught on to that quicker than I did. Yeah. And I was, you know, and I was around them for like months. But at the same time, Hamish is what, 10?
So this is something that's been whispered about and talked about for 10 years. So Jenny's had 10 years to make this out, as opposed to Claire, who was in their presence for like a couple months.
Yeah. So Jamie and Ian are in Brochmorda, we learn. They end up staying overnight due to the snow. Or, the weather, but the snow. Claire has a very hard time getting to sleep without Jamie there. A rooster crows in the middle of the night, and she yells at it. This is... I almost said Davina. Davina, too. But this is Diana at her finest. So, she yells at the crow, quote, "It's the middle of the night, you feathered bastard." And then a child cried, and Jenny lets out an expletive in Gaelic. So people are having a hard time sleeping that night. Claire decides to try her turning inward exercise to relax and hopefully get to sleep. And it works. Quote, this makes me laugh too. Quote, "Somewhere around my pancreas, I could dimly hear the sound of small Jamie pattering down the hall to his mother's bedroom." So, real quick. Assuming you went from your head to your toes, if you were doing this turning inward, how long do you think it would take you to get to sleep? Would you take a different route entirely?
Well, let's be honest. How long would it take me to figure out where my pancreas is really a more apt question. I don't know what my pancreas feels like. I can't visualize my pancreas in wherever it lives inside of my body. And it's not like it's got special feelings that I can go, oh, yes, that is my pancreas. My pancreas is very angry right now, or my pancreas is sleepy.
It's all visualization. She studied anatomy.
Yeah, and I think this is foreshadowing to some extent her increase in her ability to be very self-aware and her healing powers.
Magic. So. Her magic, yeah. Mm-hmm. So how long do you think it would take if you went from head to toe?
It would take me 10 minutes because I would get bored.
You'd fall asleep out of boredom.
Out of boredom.
So it would okay. What about you, Mandy?
Probably about the same. I don't think it would take that long.
To make it to your pancreas or your toes or just to fall asleep?
To make it to my pancreas. I mean, that's only about halfway down.
I don't know why that's funny, but you kill me, Mandy. You say, okay, coming up, I have a question. And I read this paragraph, this line, like 10 times, and I couldn't figure out what it was. So let me start. Claire observes the blessings and the price of abundant motherhood, as Diana puts it. Okay, getting up in the middle of the night to assist your child to the potty. Side note, any stories you want to share with us, Summer? Manny and I can't share that.
Not assisting. She's... Her when getting out... Little. But when she... No, because when she... And she... When she's little and when... All of those things, it was either she was in a diaper or, you know, she had a night diaper or whatever.
So
or
she was lazy.
Or she... No. Or she just
kidding.
Or she peed her bed. I mean, until she figured it out, there was no
in between.
Now she does. She'll come because we share a bathroom, so the bathroom off my bedroom. So she'll come, you know, walking into the bedroom in the middle of the night to use the bathroom. But the only thing that bothers me with that is she feels like she has to ask permission. So she's like, "Mom, can I go to the bathroom?" And I was like, "Oh my god, I would have slept through this whole endeavor if you hadn't said a word to me." But, yeah, that's the only thing that annoys me. But, yeah.
So Claire is continuing this inward journey, and now she's about near her intestines. I just love the landmarks. Okay, so here's my question. What does this mean? Claire's already, Diana's already mentioned the blessings and price of abundant motherhood. So now we have the line, quote, "There was another reason I did not envy Jenny." And it continues, "I had at first feared that the birth of Faith had done me some internal damage, but that fear had disappeared with Raymond's touch. As I completed the inventory of my body and felt my spine go slack on the edge of sleep, I could feel that all was well there. It had happened once, it could happen again. All that was needed was time and Jamie." So what does she mean by "there was another reason I did not envy Jenny"? Because the first time she says the blessings and price of abundant motherhood, she goes directly into the child getting up in the middle of the night. But then she says, there's another reason. What's this other reason? I can't find it.
But I'm wondering if that is a continuation of the previous, of the being woken.
Mm-hmm.
Because the statement before that is, there's a pot right next to your bed, Clotilde. Jenny's exasperated voice came outside my door. She steered small Jamie back to his bed. You must have stepped in it on your way out. Why can you not get it through your head to use that one? Why have you got to come use mine? And every night in creation, her voice faded as she turned up the stair, and I smiled, visualizations moving to the sweeping curves of my intestine. There was the reason I did not envy Jenny.
But that's the beginning of a chapter.
There was another reason. Like, that was another reason that maybe that encounter.
If it was in that paragraph, I would agree. But it's a brand new paragraph. And it goes, the my intestines, period. New paragraph. There was another reason I did not envy Jenny, period.
But what if it's actually pronounced, there was another reason.
Another reason.
But it doesn't fit with that, because that idea should not start a new paragraph. If that was about the thing, it would have gone with... That's what I'm trying to say. It doesn't make sense split from it. If it's about it and you're emphatic, huh, that's another reason I don't envy Jenny, it should be right after it, not a new paragraph. That's all I'm saying. So it could be that you're right, but splitting
I'll
it up...
I'll let you take that out with Diana.
Yeah, why don't you email her and ask?
No, splitting it up does not support the fact that it's continuing the idea. It's making a new statement. But it was just something I read, like, why does this not make sense? But...
My suggestion is, if you care about it that much, post a question about it in CompuServe and she'll probably answer you.
She probably will, and I don't know if I want to know. I mean, I'm curious. Obviously, I'm spending time on this.
Girl, but... I want to question your choice of punctuation and paragraph structure.
That is not what I said.
People do stranger things in CompuServe.
That is 100%
not what I said. I'm not questioning her structure. I'm asking what it means. And if she meant it to be a continuation... Or a new thought. Because when you split it, it looks like a new thought. That's all. Connie writes, Jenny and Claire are bound by family ties, but Claire is still a bit unsure of her place at Lallybroch and was concerned that the loss of her own child might make her jealous of Jenny. Instead, she finds acceptance within herself and is welcomed more deeply by Jenny into the daily life and work of the family and their property. They also share information with each other about Colm and Dougal. Their deepened understanding builds the family relationship further. Jamie and Ian don't show up the next day as early as they were expected. Jenny is confident all is well, and they had stayed, must have been staying, to do some business. Claire isn't as easily confident. She refers to the letter granting Jamie's pardon locked in a drawer. Jamie thought it was a humiliation to keep and would have burned it, but Claire had insisted they keep it. She's kind of having her own mini version of a PTSD, and I think rightly so. She'd already been through the loss of him in Outlander.
She doesn't want a repeat.
Mm-mm.
The two men return just before dark. Jamie at first avoiding telling them what's what. But then we learn why they were late. They'd had a wee accident. Then he chats at Fergus about horses and his whoopin'. Claire is starting to get a little bit pissy. Like, what are you doing? Stop avoiding this. You can't keep doing this. They see that Ian has a black eye. It's swollen, and there's a long scrape down his cheek. Ian also had a broken leg, the wooden one, in case they need a clarification. He got it from stepping into a molehole, he explained. They had then stopped at a cottage to spend the night so a new leg could be carved.
And what I remember from this scene, that you just didn't even mention it at all, was
that's
that,
why we need both of us.
Was that Jamie kissed Claire, and he was like, sausage for dinner. And I thought to myself, ew.
I love the fact that she says bangers and mash, and he has no idea what that means.
I know.
Exactly.
So Connie writes, just where did the replacement wooden leg come from, and how quickly was the broken one replaced? They had a bunch of them just in case at whatever cottage Ian might visit.
He carved one.
I know
she
he carved
it.
One, but that was heck of fast.
It's
I mean,
probably
I guess he
like...
has... experience.
It's well, he's probably had to do it before, but it's also probably like the most like rudimentary.
Right, they're not
just
leg.
Let me get home,
right,
and I'll work on something nicer there.
Right, and he probably just had to replace like a lower part of it, or like whatever the like in the series, it's got like a handle on the side of it and whatnot. But mm-hmm. I mean, if it was some other way attached to him, he probably could have reused the pieces that were still good and just like attached a piece to the bottom.
Yeah, it was probably like a leather cuff or sleeve that it slipped down into.
I like lever.
Leather.
I know that, but I thought it sounded like lever at first. A lever on a leg. I don't know what it could have done. I don't know what it could have done, but it could have been nice. At this point in the story, Summer's laughing
could
at me.
Could have been nice.
At this point in the story, Jenny is seeing to Ian, and Claire describes Ian's stump. The surgeon had been able to save the knee joint, which gave him more flexibility than he'd had have... Then he'd... Fudge a monkey knuckle.
He'd have
then
had.
He'd have had had he not. Good freaking monkey. Hold on.
I should have punctuated that.
Then he'd have had had he not had the knee... And it's grammatically correct. Holy crap. Okay, I'll try this again. The surgeon had been able to save the knee joint, which gives him more flexibility than he'd have had had he not had the knee. Besides the wooden leg being broken in the fall, the knee had also been badly twisted. We learned from Claire he'd torn a ligament. She prescribes whiskey for the pain and laudanum that night so he can sleep. And to stay in bed for a week. This is where Ian's... basically talks back and says, no, not gonna happen. Lisa T. writes, at this point, Claire becomes her brother-in-law's keeper as she examines and treats his injured leg. Claire describes Ian's look at Jamie as having, quote, pain and anger mingled with resentment. Quote, do you think you can order me? Jamie considers this and replies, quote, no, I will not try to order you. May I ask you, though, to care for yourself? Jamie is trying to protect Ian, and Ian is feeling helpless because his injury will not allow him to fulfill his duties to Jamie and Lallybroch. Here we continue to see, as we did with deceased Willie, that Ian and Jamie are each other's keepers, but fail at times to protect each other. Jamie could not protect Ian from injury, and Ian cannot serve his laird in his present condition. Ian replies to Jamie, quote, you can ask. So they get him upstairs to bed, and before he leaves the room, Ian says something to Jamie in Gaelic, and Claire thinks she understands it to be well, brother. Because Jamie replies then, you too, my brother. Mo brer? Is that right?
Mm-hmm. Do you not pronounce that?
Mo brer?
Braher? Okay. Claire is curious about this mole, whom she couldn't imagine, quote, trying to strangle him in retaliation. When they're in bed, okay, this is for Mandy. As they're in bed, Claire is massaging Jamie's injured hand, and she asks him who hurt Ian. And Jamie straight up says it was him. Claire had noticed something new and edgy between the two of them, but couldn't tell what. Lisa T. writes, this, again, is a twist on the Cain and Abel story, but in this case, Jamie was not meaning to harm Ian. Jamie tells her, quote, Ian's been married too long. And it's been like 5 years, we find out, so that's not that long, but, you know, it's
he's clearly
more than
accustomed.
Jamie.
Long enough to have set some patterns.
Right.
Oh,
he's accustomed
yeah.
to sleeping with his wife.
Long enough for Jamie to have judgment. They'd gotten shelter at a cottage and had lain together on a pallet in front of the fire. Ian had turned to Jamie in his sleep and put his arm around him and kissed the back of his neck. Quote, that must have been the hell of a shock, Claire says. Jamie replies, it was the hell of a shock to Ian. And the next day, when they had some privacy, on the way home, of course, Jamie... finally
I think
told.
You're totally glazing over the fact that he throttled him. Like, he came to himself choking Ian, scared everyone in the household because these were their honored guests. This is a laird and his, like, right-hand man, his brother-in-law, and they're, you know... trying to kill each other in their living room, basically. And I love the imagery of Mrs. Murray... just sitting up in bed and going, whoo, 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 like a deranged owl or whatever he called it.
The next day on the way home, he finally tells him about Randall and everything that had happened.
I think that's a very important scene because I think that as much as Claire had been helping Jamie to heal since Wentworth, that's his final confession and absolution, if you will, from someone who... in a lot of ways is closer to Jamie than even Claire is. And so I think that's one of the, it's a real turning point, I think, in Jamie's healing process from Wentworth.
Yeah.
It's a lot of turning points.
Definitely. Connie reminds us at this point, we know that Claire, Roger, Brianna, and Ian know that BJR raped Jamie because Claire is telling all of this to Roger and Bree.
So that was kind of, when I first read that, Connie, I was like, wait, we can't mention Roger and Bree. Oh, well, duh. They're in the beginning of the book. So this whole thing is recounting to Roger and Bree. So it's important to kind of keep that bird's eye view of what's going on. It's not just we're in the story. She's also telling it. Which, we know that DIA is Claire telling Roger and Bree.
Mm-hmm.
But what is Outlander? It's Claire telling someone. I'm wondering if that'll ever be revealed, like in the last book or something. Because it's Claire telling someone.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't know who yet.
Unless she's writing her own story.
Unless she's writing, absolutely. Unless she's writing it.
But this is a lot of story to be telling your kid. Can I tell you that?
Oh, you mean just book two?
Yeah, I mean, if she's literally telling this story.
Yeah.
It's a lot. I'm just saying, that's a very graphic tale.
It's quite deep, Connie. Lisa T. writes, this harkens back a bit to the discussion of Colm and Dougal. Jamie and Ian have a deep symbiotic relationship with each other, as do Colm and Dougal. Thankfully, they each have their own cocks and brains. But Ian is Jamie's right hand, and Jamie his legs. While the incident may have been what made Jamie tell Ian at this particular time, I honestly think Jamie would have told him eventually. He says, quote, Ian, well, he knows me, do you see? He's only a year older than me. When I was growing, he was always there. Until I was 14, there wasn't a day went by when I didn't see Ian. End quote. And when he'd gone away and come home, it was like he'd never left. Quote, Ian, he's the part of me that belongs here that never left. So Jamie felt that not telling him would mean he would feel apart from Ian and apart from his home. So I really do think that the circumstance, and obviously he had to tell him after we almost killed him. But I think he would have come out. He's telling us right there. As long as Ian didn't know, he felt apart. It wasn't a complete homecoming. Connie writes, Jamie's relationship with Ian is one of the most important in his life. He and Ian go way back and have grown up together, shared battle, fought for and protected each other, and have had few, if any, secrets from each other. Jamie's actions during a nightmare in the Murray Cottage had provoked the revelation of his trauma. And Jamie can't stand that Ian doesn't know and understand what he went through. He didn't intend to tell Ian about it, but when the situation arises that there has to be some sort of explanation for his attack on Ian in the night, the divulging of the truth gives Jamie a chance to reclaim some of his self. BJR violated Jamie profoundly, not just by his physical action, but by BJR's, quote, biblical and psychological knowledge of the inner Jamie that wasn't his by right or gift. This disrupted Jamie's sense of self and his sense of where he fit in the world, including even Lallybroch, his home, and in his relationships. This disruption is countered by Jamie sharing this deepest shame with Ian and by their emotional and physical confrontation over it. Diana's use of humor in the most deep emotional scenes is something that she's known for. So an example of this here, Ian wanted to stomp around, but he couldn't because of his leg. Jamie wanted to beat Ian, but he couldn't because of his leg. And he wanted to hit Jamie, but he couldn't because of his leg. So they rode a long time after that, and after a while, Jamie could hear Ian weeping. Then he held out his hand to Jamie and squeezed it. Lisa T. writes, at the beginning of the chapter, we saw Robbie McNabb. This reminds us again of the fact that his father, Robbie McNabb, one of the tenants, betrayed Jamie. Ian feels that he is responsible for the betrayal and is angry with himself for not being able to protect his laird and friend. Ian does make sure that McNabb answered for betraying Jamie, but now that Ian knows the whole truth about what happened to Jamie, he feels that he betrayed Jamie to his fate at the hands of Jack Randall, that he was unable to be his brother's keeper. The next morning, Jamie has a gift for Claire, several copper doits. So I had to look that up, of course. According to Merriam-Webster, a doit is an old Dutch coin equal to about an eighth of a stiver or stiver.
And a stiver?
Then I had to look up stiver or stiver or stiever. Quote, a unit of value and coin of the Netherlands equal to 1/20th of a gulden.
And that is?
So I'd heard of, at least I'd heard of the gulden. So that is the, was the basic monetary unit of the Netherlands until 2002, which of course was the time when the euro came in.
So a gulden would be the equivalent of a dollar.
Probably a gulden, but, well, not the equivalent monetarily, but it's their
their money.
Unit.
Right. Yeah, their unit. Thank you, Maddie. Along with the Doits, the Doits, there were several small rocks, a short stick wrapped with fish line, a letter, and hair ribbons. She thanks him for the ribbons, thinking obviously that those are the ones for her, and they're not for her. As he goes through the stones to see which one is for her, he licks one, goes through a sporran until he finds another one and licks it and presents it to her. It's a piece of amber. It's a gift for their first anniversary.
Oh my God. Dear future husband, please don't lick a gift you're going to hand to me.
Well, or stuff that's just been floating around in your sporran, which we know he's been keeping things like dead mole's feet.
Oh my God, right?
Oh my gosh. Rabbit's feet and stuff in it.
Yes.
Gross.
And we learn that she still has the larger chunk of amber from the dragonfly in amber from Human Row in her medicine box. We also learned that Jamie had been in the Bastille on their actual anniversary in June rather than the December it was now, and Claire had been also with the King of France. So it's...
Nobody was in a celebratory mood.
No, I know. And so it happened. It's almost
the king, maybe.
And it's just...
It didn't seem to be.
Nah, it was all...
Oh my goodness. So it's, I guess, about, so we know it's December, and we guess it's about Hogmanay, because we learn that it's time for new beginnings, and that is kind of the theme of the end of the chapter. And looking through his items, Claire sees two other yellow lumps he's taken from his sporran. They're honey balls, we learn. He dusts them off and offers her one.
Nope. I am not eating any dusty-covered anything out of somebody's sporran or out of somebody's purse. It's like that fuzzy piece of gum at the bottom of your aunt's purse. Or
yeah, exactly.
I mean, no way.
Connie writes, Fergus, adapting to his new surroundings, having other children near his age, this may be the first time Fergus has ever had a chance to be a child. And this is more on the theme of relationships that Connie mentioned earlier. So Jenny and Claire, being sisters-in-law, working together and sharing bits and pieces of their lives, worrying over their men together. Colum and Dougal, as discussed by Jenny and Claire. Jamie and Claire, more time spent as a married couple, getting more comfortable with each other, and Claire being concerned when Jamie is away. And then we have Jamie and Ian, how they grew up together, and how Ian's father taught Jamie to fight left-handed and taught Ian to literally guard his weaker side, and how seriously Ian takes the responsibility of looking out for Jamie. Another theme that Connie found striking was the knowing theme. Jamie and Claire know each other in the biblical sense as man and wife, but they also have a deeper metaphysical bond in their marriage than Claire did with Frank. They are also much happier when they are physically proximate to each other. Witness Claire's discomfort when she's watching out the windows for Jamie and Ian's return. She says, I'm reminded of Claire watching for Jamie from the front steps of Lallybroch in the episode called The Watch from season one. We can sense her unease because their bond is being tested by physical distance and the danger of what can happen. Connie also shares this quote, to be loved but not known is comforting but superficial. To be known and not loved is our greatest fear. But to be fully known and truly loved is, well, a lot like being loved by God. It is what we need more than anything. It liberates us from pretense, humbles us out of our self-righteousness, and fortifies us for any difficulty life can throw at us. End quote. And that was Timothy Keller from The Meaning of Marriage, Facing the Complexities of Commitment with the Wisdom of God. So that's a very fitting quote to her theme of knowing and relationships. Finally, Lisa T. writes, the entire chapter is full of variations on being thy brother's keeper. It begins with the little boys fighting and making peace reminiscent of Jamie and Ian as children. The chapter then ends with Jamie and Ian forgiving each other and coming home. Even though they have failed to be each other's keeper at times, they are beginning again. They have redefined for each other what it means to be thy brother's keeper. They are no longer the children who made a blood vow to each other, but adults who, while vowing to be each other's keeper, realize that they may fail, not because they mean to, like Cain, but because they are human. So this was a lot more of a, like, almost everything.
I feel like our contributors definitely tried to take us to church this week.
It is. I mean, knowing Diana's background and a lot of the themes she has at different times are Christian or Christian-based themes. It makes perfect sense. And of course, the title, I mean, it's pretty obvious that there's that relationship or theme, I should say. How was that, Mandy, for a non-sexy chapter?
No, it's a great chapter. I like the, it's the scenes of daily life pieces that I like, in the books anyway, that are my favorite.
I'm glad you said that because this chapter is the last one of them.
Yeah.
The next chapter, something comes down, and after that, it's gone. It's funny that you say that and you join us on the last chapter that has even a hint of a pastoral quality.
Thank you.
So that being said, that was chapter 33, Thy Brother's Keeper. Be sure to join us on our next episode when we will be discussing chapters 34 and 35, because 34 is rather brief. So we thought we would do them together. So 34 is The Postman Always Rings Twice. And 35 is entitled Moonlight.
Okay, so I was wrong. 34 is not the last chapter that's pastoral at all in nature and that shatters. 34 is the chapter that shatters any hopes of pastoral-ness, itty, however you make that.
When did you start pronouncing pastoral as pastoral?
Never L, Al.
You're missing the point.
No, I know what you're saying. I'll tell you
pastoral.
Why.
Your emphasis pastoral. Was on the wrong syllable.
The reason is because I studied music, and in music, there is a type of music, a type of piece called pastoral. And I think that's why I say pastoral. Sorry, it's the music major nerd coming out of me. So yes, pastoral. Thank you. So I was right. 34 is the one that shatters stuff. But 35 is like the last remnant of
the pastoral.
Thank you. I probably better not say that word.
I said it wrong on purpose. The pastoral.
See, and I didn't correct you because it sounded right.
Exactly. She didn't even get it when I was making fun of her.
I didn't. So thank you, Mandy, for being with us again.
My pleasure.
And thank you.
You don't want to thank me for being here?
Summer, you're always
you're
here.
You're legally required to be.
It really is that bad.
It's that bad. What is this?
I'm legally required.
Oh.
So that's like, did you ever see, what was the movie with Robert Redford and the blonde? The where she plays the weather girl and then becomes the newswoman.
Oh, Nicole Kidman.
Rachel McAdams?
No, older than that. We're talking an older movie.
Michelle Pfeiffer?
Yes, Michelle Pfeiffer. I'm like, it starts with an M.
Isn't that called?
Up Close and Personal?
Yes, that's it.
Yeah, Up Close and Personal. Where he says, I'm already here every day. And she says, I want you legally required to be.
Okay, so it's not that legally required to be.
Well, yeah. Because that would be weird.
It's not sanctioned by any.
Speaking of churches.
County or government. But yes, thank you again, as always, for joining us, Mandy.
My pleasure.
And dear listener, thank you so much, as always, for listening. We look forward to our next episode.
Thank you to our generous audio host, audioboom.com. Our Audioboom channel is www.audioboom.com/channel/OutlanderPod. Visit our website at www.outlanderpod.com. Follow us on Twitter at OutlanderPod. Find us on Facebook at www.facebook.com/OutlanderPod. Or email us at outlanderpod@gmail.com.